everyone, welcome back to the Talking Spook podcast for episode 32. We are this week. I am Rob Calder. With me, I have Mike Zeppel. Welcome, Mike.
Robbie, and with us today we have... Oh, no, he isn't.
No, he is not. We have succumbed to popular demand and Shula is gone. So true to his word, he has now started his gig at Melbourne United and he's no longer to be found at the BV offices, so everyone can stop calling here looking for him. That would be great.
There is a nasty rumour going on that he was fired from the pod. I categorically want to say that that is true. He was removed from the podcast through a spate of poor performances.
Well, not turning up probably being the main performance that we found out. Cool.
It's a key performance indicator right there, Robbie.
It turns out it is. So, same as we do every week, if you can subscribe to the podcast, you can do that on Spotify and on iTunes. When this hits social media, if you can like, share, retweet, all the sorts of things to help grow the audience, that would be fantastic for us. We'd really appreciate it on our end. And ratings and reviews, only takes a couple of minutes to get done on both, but we do really appreciate it when those come in. So, we sort of touched on it a little bit last week. Obviously, once we'd kicked Shula out the door, we did need to have a guest on on the podcast. Mm-hmm. And we've gone and found what I think is a really probably overqualified one.
What I like is that when he has not shown up or has been resigned, that we replace Shula with doctors. So we could not go further in the opposite end of the spectrum than getting doctors on the podcast.
No, we have. And we are really lucky that we have Dr. Adam Gorman jumping on the podcast. So Adam is a lecturer in motor control and learning at the University of the Sunshine Coast. He's done a lot of work in the basketball space, obviously. He's done some work with their Boomers up at the AIS when they were the AIS. They're COE now. In regard to skill acquisition. So it's a really important topic, obviously, with a number of our coaches and our listeners being involved at that end where they deal with junior athletes and need to try and make them as good a player as they possibly can.
Yeah, he spent 10 years at the AIS, so you can imagine in 10 years the quality of athlete that he was able to not only work with but also evaluate and see what is working in skill acquisition, what the training environment looks like, how does the quality or the product of the game reflect what is going on the training floor as well. So he's awesome. We appreciate him joining us, obviously.
Absolutely do. We'll get started with Adam in a second. I do warn you guys, the internet connection was a little sketchy at State Basketball Centre, so there will be a couple of times it drops out, but overall it's a really good listen, and we do appreciate Adam's time. We'll get started with him now. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Split. We have got Dr. Adam Gorman with us, who is the lecturer in motor control and learning at the University of Sunshine Coast. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you, Rob. Nice to be here.
Excellent. I've hit on your current title, of course, but there's a lot more to it. Do you want to give us a little bit of background about yourself and your work in the skill acquisition field?
Yeah, sure. So I might start with my basketball participation, I suppose. I played the game for about 35 years or so, which isn't bad given that I'm only 30 years of age. But I never played at a really high level, but certainly have an investment in the sport, love watching it, love playing it. I started in, I suppose, skill acquisition in a sense when I finished university. I was a secondary school teacher, and so working as a physical education teacher where it's very similar to skill acquisition at an elite level or an institute of sport, et cetera, just a different, different outcomes you're trying to achieve in essence. Then 4 years of teaching, and then I was fortunate to have got a position at the Australian Institute of Sport in Canberra, and ended up working there for 10 years, which was just tremendous, and immersed very much in elite level, and certainly that sort of developmental level of basketball player, so men's and women's, and that they're kind of the players are on the cusp of taking that next step to either NBL and in some instances NBA level. So around 17, 18 year olds. And then since then I've started working in academia, working at the Uni of the Sunshine Coast, as you mentioned. And that role, believe it or not, is very similar to what I was doing at AIS. It involves a teaching component, of course, from trying to teach up-and-coming sports scientists to essentially spread the word of skill acquisition principles, but also work just as much with a range of sports, and certainly basketball is prominent on that list, as in terms of, well, very similar to the number of sports, the amount of time I spent working with them at the AIS, just from the elite level. So working with the likes of NBL teams, and certainly that the grassroots sport from kids just first starting out. And that latter aspect's probably the key difference. AIS was obviously at the pointy end where they're already identified as talented, but it's a real eye-opener and certainly beneficial to me to see that the real grassroots sport, where you've got 10-year-old kids just starting the sport for the first time.
That's excellent. It's, you're talking my language there, because I am coaching under 12s this year, and we have enough problems just staying upright, let alone dribbling a basketball and shooting at the same time. So, I mean, what is first with motor learning in basketball? Where do you start with a lot of the younger athletes?
Yeah, look, it's a really good question. And I think it comes down to the individual level. There's going to be certain individuals who need, I suppose, an understanding of just the basic concepts of the sport, which may include just an understanding of how their body moves. And then there's others who are going to be, for whatever reason, already relatively advanced. Now, I tend to look at it as, I suppose, in line with that individual focus, tend to think of it looking at three key elements. And this isn't my theory. It's called the theory of optimal readiness, or words to that effect, where you look at the maturity of the individual, the prior experiences, and the third one just escapes me for a second. I'll come back to it. So in terms of maturity, you kind of put it this way. If you're trying to teach a 10-year-old kid to dunk, well, not many of them, in fact, none that I've ever seen, have the maturity to be able to jump that high to dunk a basketball at a full-size ring. So they're not ready, in other words, to learn that particular skill. Similar to three-point shooting, a lot of them simply don't have the physical capability to actually throw the ball that far. And if you look at the other aspects, so not only that element of the physical status of the person, but also their prior experiences. Again, coming back to that individual nature of the person, some 10-year-olds have already played 2 or 3 years of basketball at whatever level, and they're probably ready to learn some more advanced concepts than someone who's just starting for the very first time. And so that when you look at it from that perspective, it comes down, as I said, to that individual level. And that's really where the art, and I know that's a bit of a cliched term, but the art of coaching comes into it. I think one thing to be wary of is that irrespective of whether they're playing for the Boomers or just starting out playing basketball for the first time at age 5, that there's core principles that I think are still important. And a lot of those principles revolve around allowing kids and the individual, whether they're a kid or an adult, to explore. And by exploration, I mean providing opportunities for the kids to, I keep saying kids, it can be any age level or any skill level, but opportunities to find what works and what doesn't work. And often we sort of shy away from that because obviously the finding out what doesn't work aspect is typically characterized as a mistake. My philosophy, and certainly that of the majority of people in skill acquisition, is that whilst you could certainly categorize it as a mistake, really it's just a solution that didn't work. And it might be semantics, but in order to find what works, you really do have to do some trial and error. And so as a coach, I think it's recognizing what the individual requires, carefully constructing whatever activity it may be to allow that individual to explore and find out what strategy does work, what doesn't work. It might be decision making, it might be how I move my body, it might be a particular basketball skill. But giving them that chance to explore solve their own problems. But with the coach there as being the guiding force, I suppose, not dictating and saying, no, stop, I want you to hold your hand like this, I want you to move like this, letting the individual sort of figure some things out. There's certainly going to be times where, and this is definitely my experience with coaches, that they're awesome, often at identifying a key factor that can really help progress that individual, take some massive steps. But importantly, that key factor in the form of often feedback or demonstration, instructions provided by the coach, that comes in at a certain point in time when the person just needs it. They've had enough time trying to figure things out for themselves, and it's time to give them a little bit of guidance. And then step back again and let them go from there. So it's sort of, it makes it a bit tough in that it comes down to each coach being able to look at what their kids or their team need, and being able to be creative in the way they deliver that, but allowing the individuals to figure stuff out for themselves. So it makes it difficult in that there's no particular recipe and say, do this, you should start with this, then progress to this. That's very much a sort of a structured, or what we'd call a linear progression, whereas we know that people, they don't, we don't progress in a linear fashion. Even the way we grow in terms of our height, we have these growth spurts, and learning of skills is the same. One practice session, there'll be someone who think, geez, they're just not getting this, and for whatever reason, the very next practice session, they turn up and think, where'd that come from? I haven't seen you do that ever. And all of a sudden, you can do it today. So that's that non-linear element, which, again, makes it challenging for coaches and players. But that's the reality of being a human being.
Yeah, and you can see how that would be frustrating to a coach if you are consistently in this environment talking skill development, acquisition, and the kid's not getting it. How far along does the coach go? And I'm sure this is a challenge in junior basketball around the country. How far do you go down that development pathway before, you know, just changing, just throwing your hands up in the air, I can't do it anymore, let's just do this, and not let that athlete actually get to that skill growth spurt, which may be only a week, 2 weeks, a month away?
Exactly. And again, as cliche as it sounds, I'm not trying to dodge sort of a question, I guess. It does come down to that real art of being able to make that judgment call. That's why coaching is not easy. Able to say, yep, this person at this point in time would really benefit from me stepping in and just helping them out. I can tell them, yep, try this, I want you to try this, and knowing full well that that's probably likely to help them and help solve that problem, versus looking at them and thinking, I could tell them right now, but then it might actually do more harm than good, because by telling them, I'm imposing upon them a technique or a strategy that may not be ideal for them. Plus, I'm encouraging that element of dependency. If I step in too frequently and offer too much information, then all of a sudden the player starts to figure out that, well, I don't really have to solve problems for myself. I'll just wait for the coach to tell me, because that's going to happen anyway. So it's that real fine line. I think you look for characteristics, and often they're things such as levels of motivation. As everyone's aware, if you try to learn a skill or even refine an existing skill, it's challenging. And there can be points in time where you just think, I just don't know what to do. I don't know how to get past this to improve. And that's the ideal time for a coach to step in and say, hey, look, let me give you a bit of guidance here. A statement, again, I wish it was mine, but it's not my statement, or I didn't come up with it.
We've stolen a lot of things on this podcast, Adam. It's all right.
This one I really like, and it's very simple. Let the game be the teacher.
Yeah.
So to me, that has a lot of things implied within it, mostly that you, again, being the coach, you're very creative in what you do, and you create situations in whatever activity, whatever it looks like, as long as it's safe, of course, so that to allow that person, the player, to figure things out. And the game is, the activity doesn't necessarily have to be a full-on game. It teaches them what they need to do, and sometimes the player might not even be aware of what they're learning or that they've learned something. But again, it is challenging. There's no question. That's why not everyone gets into coaching, because I think it is a challenging career path, but it's certainly a very, very rewarding one.
Absolutely. You mentioned body movement before, just briefly, and you do hear it, like if you're talking, you know, coach talk, or you're just watching kids play, you kind of just look at them like, yeah, well, he or she moves like a basketball player. You can just tell, and it's interesting how that develops in some athletes and it just doesn't develop in others, which is really interesting. My whole thought on a lot of this elementary skill development and acquisition is hopefully in those environments where you are with the athlete, you can show them enough and teach them enough and give them this little bit of motivation to where they can take what you're teaching them, go to their backyard or go in their driveway, and that's where they get that growth spurt, because behind closed doors, they have fallen in love with that acquisition so much that here comes the spurt. And I think we've got to be patient with our athletes in that phase, because we do want to continually identify and label athletes as under 16 national team players or under 15 Southern Cross Challenge, whatever it is, whatever the competition is. And we've got so much going on in Australia, I think we can lose sight that these growth spurts do take place at different times throughout this development pathway.
You're absolutely spot on. There's no question that the backyard is a very fruitful place for developing skill, and you only have to look at, well, not only the anecdotal evidence that exists. We ask or you hear expert athletes interviewed about what they've done, and they'll often say, oh yeah, in the backyard or pick up games or whatever it was, they learn so much. And it's interesting that they learn a lot in an environment where it's very similar to what I described before. You're letting the players explore. They figure out what works and what doesn't. There's no one there to, because it's so unstructured, there's typically not a parent or a coach coaching them. Just, yep, figure it out, just play. And they'll also, I like the fact that in that environment, they'll also try almost anything. You go for the biggest block you possibly can. You try to do the best crossover dribble to evade your immediate defender.
Absolutely, yeah.
Stuff just comes out. And the best, you'll try and take these crazy, are often categorized as being bad shots. But, geez, I think you need to practice that in that sort of environment and be sort of let off the leash in a sense to be able to just try stuff.
Hey, so I absolutely 100% agree. So my thought on that would be that the Europeans are able to play basketball and soccer with so much flair because they play so much soccer and basketball in the backyard, on the playground, where they are just, and that's just their nature and that's just what their countries are like. They are able to demonstrate this flair, where here in Australia, we are always playing 5-on-5 for a club, for a team, for a school, for a domestic association. I think with finding that balance is really important for your 10 to 16 year old athletes.
Oh, definitely. And what's happening now, again, I'm not aware of research specifically on this, but just from what I hear and observe, if you're talented at whatever age, you're picked up pretty quickly by a lot of sports, basketball included, and instantly placed within what tends to be a relatively structured program where you're exposed to structured practice sessions. Whereas, I don't know, 20 years ago, 30, 40 years ago, the situation's probably a bit different, where if you're talented, well, you're probably not picked up until, I don't know, 16, 17 years of age. And that's when you're sort of brought into a focused development program with more structured coaching. So there's potentially, again, if these observations and anecdotes are accurate, there's the potential that kids aren't getting as much sort of backyard practice, in inverted commas, as what they once did. And that potentially could be detrimental because, well, actually, it may not be if the, I'll take a step back, may not be detrimental if the programs that these players are brought into take on a philosophy of more of that exploration and, in essence, a backyard approach, where it is an environment where, yep, we stand back, we create these clever activities and let the players figure stuff out. And if they want to try to do some moves that are you perhaps wouldn't try in a game, but they want to try it in practice, well, we encourage that rather than say, no, geez, you just had your shot blocked twice because you've tried these unusual sorts of techniques. That shuts down creativity. And I think creativity, that is developed in an environment where it's encouraged. And that's your backyard environment. So really, we probably almost need to think about recreating the backyard environment in the structured program so we don't lose that creativity. And
that's it, yeah. So if you are going to lose the background, let's just hope that the association or the country has that that background that does allow development. Robbie and I did some research into Slovenian basketball throughout the course of the year, and they've got some really interesting documentation online, but they essentially say that they don't teach screening until after under 14s, and there's no sets or plays until under 14s. And this is a country of 2 million people that is a renowned contender on the international stage, Olympics and World Cups and Euro Cups. And it's just interesting how their development philosophy is, this is your playground. Go out there and play, and we're not teaching you any actions or sets or plays, but let's see who can play a bit of basketball out there.
Yeah, I like that. I really like it. It's that real sort of a hands-off approach. Again, set the scene, provide the infrastructure, and allow the players to play. I think that's where that element of flair and creativity comes from. Again, if it's not encouraged, if it's not rewarded, then it's pretty quickly shut down. And that's where you see the more of the robotic player. And I don't know of a coach, never heard of a coach saying, I want 5 robots on the court. I want players to be creative and think for themselves. But sometimes, and I'm not meaning to be critical here, but sometimes they need to be given the opportunity to be creative in a practice session and in games, for that matter, in order for that roboticness, I think I just made up a word there.
Love it. We do that here too, Adam.
So yeah, I think it's critical. I really do. And it doesn't mean a lot of people think, oh, that means as a coach we become redundant. And I don't think it means that at all. I think it actually places a greater role in the coach because it's more difficult and takes more expertise and understanding to be able to coach in a creative manner where you are letting the activities do the teaching for you in one sense than it does to get people in lines and have everything so structured and rigid. And that's easy to do because everyone knows where they should be, but the rigidity just it squashes creativity, and they learn and often they just get put off as well. It's a bit boring and repetitive, and kids switch off. Adults switch off, for that matter.
Yeah. We hope no one's switching off this podcast to our listeners. I'm sure this is an interesting conversation to all of them. But so if we were to teach the skill of a jump shot to a young athlete, say an under 12 athlete for argument's sake, is there any merit at all in teaching that 1-on-0, or are we better off just letting them trial and error that within gameplay, small-sided games, those sorts of functions instead? Which way will actually help the skill sink in better and give them, I don't want to say correct technique because everyone's technique is going to be a little bit different, but which one is going to set them up for success later on in life?
Look, I think the closer you can get to a game-like environment, typically the better it's going to be, but there are some caveats around that. If you've got what age group did you say?
Under 12, yep.
Under 12s? Okay, so if that child is pretty overwhelmed just by trying to jump and shoot the ball while they're in the air, then adding a defender and complicating the environment, that could make it so overwhelming that it becomes near on impossible for them to perform. So that's where you just be a bit clever, I think. And again, it keeps coming back down to the level of the individual. If they can cope with some defensive pressure, well, that's perfect because now anything that's any issue in a sense, with their skill, is probably going to be found out, I suppose. So if they have a if they release the ball too low, or they don't jump high enough, or they get too close to the defender, whatever it may be, all of a sudden they'll realise that, hey, I'm getting my shot blocked quite a bit here, or the ball's hit out of my hands, or I don't have enough time to shoot the ball. So in the presence of a defender, all that information becomes real. They get consequences for their action. And I don't mean consequences in terms of you miss the shot, do 20 push-ups. I mean consequences in that if I have a low load height in my shot, well, it's going to get blocked more often than not. Or if I'm too slow in executing it, it'll get blocked. So those consequences start to shape the way in which you perform that skill. However, coming back to where I started, if that player is really struggling to do just the basic movements, then you might take the defender away and you might start them off in just a really simple environment, and that's okay. It becomes an issue if it's done for too long, I think. But even just adding a coach in front of that player and the coach just standing still and having the player run up and shoot over the top of the coach, all of a sudden now, depending on the height of the coach, they've got to get elevation on their jump, their shot. They start to calibrate certain information such as how close do I need to be to the coach before when I jump, I sort of bump into the coach, and how far away do I need to be to maximise my the shot itself. So that, I think it's all relative to the individual again. But if you can introduce some sort of defensive pressure of some description, then that individual is hopefully more likely to develop a technique that's going to hold up in under defensive pressure. And we often, there's a concept or theory that I really like. At its basic level, it is pretty simple. It's called the challenge point theory. It's Guadagnoli and Lee, 2004, came up with this. And I present it to coaches frequently. All it suggests is that this happy medium for a challenge point, and it's, again, based on the individual performer. So we can come up with an activity that's just so easy that it's really not challenging the individual. And as a result, then they don't have to explore or figure stuff out. And so what happens is they don't learn as much. But we can also go to the other extreme where the activity is so difficult for that individual that they equally, there's so much information, so much going on to attract their attention that they also can't figure out anything, and learning is also impeded. So it's this happy medium. And one of the reasons I like it is because it highlights again that the individual is the important characteristic here. So you give LeBron James an activity where he has to shoot against two defenders. Well, that's probably his challenge point. He's going to be that's it might even be three defenders before he's actually challenged. But if you put two defenders on a 10-year-old and say, hey, now you've got to shoot over the top of them, they're probably overwhelmed. It's far too difficult. So it all comes down to the challenge point for that particular person. And I think what happens, again, this is, well, there's research on this, and I observe it every now and then as well. We tend to coach at the low end where we're not challenging players to progress. The activities are just, you can see it when the players perform it. They don't have to think. They're not really being challenged in any way to try something a bit, it's a bit too easy. But, I like the concept.
Yeah. So if we were to take, for argument's sake, an athlete's jump shot that's 15 that has had fairly minimal coaching, is that too late to change their shooting technique if it's just the form's poor, it's really flat, there's no arc on the shot? Is it too difficult to change it at 15 years old, or is it still possible?
Yeah, good question. There's two steps that are important. One is obviously trying to find out what the problem may be. And so you simply look at the technique and what's going on and gather information. And often it comes down to a bit of a a gut feel, really. But again, coaches are good at that. You might look at video footage, etc. But the next step is trying to find out the actual underlying cause of that problem. So if you identify that it's a wrist snap or lack of ability to jump or whatever it is, the technique, then you've got to try to, if you can, find out what's actually causing that. So it may not have anything to do with skill per se. It could be that it's a fatigue issue. So it might be something to address in the gym or with appropriate nutrition. It could be a decision-making issue. It may be that they're actually taking a jump shot when they shouldn't be. And so it looks like the technique is a bit awry, but in actual fact, it's more the case that, well, they're probably just making bad decisions and they're shooting against two defenders and it's making their technique look bad. So those two key factors, I think, are really important, because if you're not addressing the cause, obviously you're just addressing the symptoms and you may or may not get a positive outcome. And the important thing is that it can be rectified. And the longer it's been practiced in the, you know, what we'll call the incorrect or non-ideal technique, is the longer it takes to change it, typically. But from my point of view, the other important factor is that it's worth persisting. If it needs to change, and that's a call made by the coach, typically, if there's enough evidence to suggest that, yeah, look, they're just not executing that shot, it's getting blocked all the time, it's not going in the basket very often, whatever it may be, then you make the call and yep, we need to change it. The other alternative is to look at it and think, well, it doesn't look pretty, it's not textbook, but is it successful? Well, yes. And is it going to hold up under higher levels of competition? If the answer is also yes, well, you might sort of question whether it needs to be fixed at all. But if you do make the decision to change it, then it can be changed, and it takes a lot of effort. And certainly the listeners are no doubt would be aware of this just as well as I am, that it's not easy to change an existing technique. It can be done, as I said, but it takes a lot of motivation on the part of, well, not only the coach, but certainly the player to want to change it. And if they don't really want to change it, it's very difficult to change.
It was like you were reading my mind, Adam.
So what you're telling us is Justin Shuler's jump shot, there is still hope. At the age of 37, he can still get this thing right and he's a chance.
We can always change, yeah.
What I tell our athletes and parents, mate, is like shooting is a time-intensive endeavor. And I actually just don't think athletes shoot enough for them to get very good at the skill. And I think there's a miss, let me see if I get this word out right, Robbie, prioritization. There's a misprioritization while we're making stuff up. I'll make that word up, of actually how important shooting is to your overall ability and chances to play at an elite or high-performing level. Like, I don't think it's valued as much as what it should be. And then it's time intensive. Like, I compare it to a golf swing. If you think you're going to have a good golf swing on 60 minutes of practicing your swing a week, there's no way. Mm-hmm. And shooting is one of those really interesting techniques. It's not natural at all to shoot a basketball the way basketball players shoot the basketball. And it does take a ton of work, which I don't know we get into a lot of our athletes.
And you know, again, another good point. If I was someone into the sports science and basically try to educate coaches and players as to best practice, if I was coaching on a day-to-day basis, I would actually be conducting what we'd probably call like a practice audit, in a sense, to basically look at my practice session and quite literally look at how many shot attempts players are taking in a given practice session. You might record this just on a video, or just have someone actually sitting on the sideline tallying up every shot that's taken by every athlete. And so looking at the time devoted to shooting, the amount of shots that are taken, and just as important as those two variables is the environment in which those shots are executed. So there's shooting practice and there's shooting practice. And if that practice, as we discussed earlier, if it involves a defender and it's game-like and requires that the shooter to adapt their shot and be able to cope with fatigue, with defensive pressure, with time pressure and basically all the elements that they need to be able to cope with in a game, then that's likely to transfer to the game environment more so than taking 100 shots from the same location all in a row. I know I'll mention some names here that they've certainly helped to educate me. Ian Stacker, I met him at the AIS, Australian Institute of Sport. He was working there, and he used to equate shooting practice, was equated to one-on-one, because admittedly, that the higher caliber of athlete by the time they get there, but shooting practice wasn't necessarily taking a huge volume of shots. It was taking quality shots or more quality practice is a better term, not quality shots. Quality practice where those shots were performed in an environment where the players had to make decisions and adapt and so forth. So that's good quality practice. And the other person who, again, influenced me, Andre Lamanis, so the head coach of the Boomers and Brisbane Bullets, he and I have discussed quite a lot about basketball and skill acquisition and so forth. And we looked at it was pretty straightforward, quite a brief little piece of research, I guess you'd call it, where we simply looked at the time between, this is in elite level games, I think it was actually in the Olympic Games around 2012 or thereabouts, where we simply looked at the time between every shot for half a dozen players in the team. And we found that, and we're talking not just game time, we're talking actual elapsed real time. We found that even the players who shot the ball quite a bit, they had in the order of minutes, on average, we're talking minutes between each shot. Some, of course, would be, it might be a few seconds between two shots, but overall, we're talking several minutes. So there was, we kind of used that to help educate the players to say, look, often they wanted to get into what they'd call rhythm. And of course, we all want to get into shooting rhythm and whatever other rhythm, dribbling rhythm, passing rhythm, playing rhythm. But they were kind of mistakenly, in a sense, confusing the need to be in this rhythm to what's actually required in a game environment, which is you just got to get the ball and shoot. You're not allowed to take 15 shots before that shot and ask the defense to just stop and wait while you do that. I'm being a bit facetious now, but it's a case of, well, you need to get the ball and shoot it. You don't have the luxury of waiting till you're in rhythm. And so if you're practicing in an environment where you only feel comfortable and you're only accurate when you're shooting in rhythm, i.e. rhythm being several shots in a row now from the same location, well, you're really not preparing yourself adequately for what you're about to be exposed to in a game environment.
That was my philosophy, mate, when I played. I would not pass because I didn't want to mess with my shooting rhythm. My teammates love that.
Yes. We were just going through Zeppel's playing stats before, and shockingly enough, did not highlight the games where he only took 10 shots. It was the ones where he took 34 he was pretty happy with. Different for everyone, I suppose. So if we're talking about young athletes and skill acquisition, do you find that in the coaches that you've worked with, as a general rule, we tend to overcomplicate things a little bit as coaches and put too many rules in place for young athletes at training sessions to actually learn?
Oh, I think, yes, definitely. And basketball is similar to some other sports where the coach is in training and in competition, the coach is in close proximity to the players. And so the coach can provide sort of an ongoing commentary of what's going on. They can provide frequent advice and feedback, instructions, and you'll see it often. And they're trying to do it for the right reasons, which is good. They're trying to develop players and help them along. So that there's no problem with the with the intent. It's just that what obviously can happen is the players switch off and start to wait for the coach to tell them what to do rather than figuring it out for themselves. And so when you compare that to other sports, so the field-based sports, the coach is often miles away. Well, sorry, not miles away, but they're in a box on the sideline and can't have as greater impact on the game itself. So players have to figure out what to do because the coach isn't within close enough proximity to be able to provide any feedback or suggestions. So I think that in itself can lead to a point where it does become complicated. And I reckon that ideally players probably should start off by understanding just the core principles of the game, not necessarily all the specifics, because you can really get bogged down in that. And there's evidence to suggest that too much information leads to what's colloquially termed paralysis by analysis, where you've just got too much to try to process and you just don't know what to do. And everything slows down and doesn't not ideal for skill acquisition. So just some key points around the key principles. I mean, things like, well, what do you try to do in attack? Well, often you're trying to get an open scoring opportunity. And so the next step, well, how do you do that? Well, you stretch the defense. If the defense are all matched up and guarding all these ideal locations, well, they've got the advantage. So you need to do something to disrupt or perturb the defenders so that you create opportunities for yourself. And then the specifics start to emerge from that point, I think. If you know the outcome that you're trying to achieve, well, the outcome is we want to try to get a high percentage shot. And so how do we do that? Okay, well, we need to stretch and disrupt the defenders in some way. And then the specifics would be, okay, well, how do we disrupt them and stretch them? Or it might be as simple as just making sure that we're spread out in our attacking formation on the court so that the defenders aren't close enough to defend two players at once. We're pulling them out so that we create space in the middle of the key, for example. Or it might be as simple as posting up in the right location, hand up, calling for the ball. And it may be that, well, you know that really I probably shouldn't get the ball here. I'm not in great position, but I'm doing it to make sure that I engage a couple of defenders to create opportunities for my teammates. So those latter aspects are all the sort of the specifics which you could go on ad nauseum to create a huge list of what they are. But if you start with the principles that underpin what you're trying to do, and what we'd call the task goal, what is it that you're trying to achieve? And the rest, the process takes care of itself in many instances when you know what outcome you want to actually achieve. The problem arises, I think, sometimes when players are given so much of the process information that they forget about the outcome. And the classic is, and I'm sure we've all seen it, the classic is the perfect set offense that just looks awesome. And then the last player gets the ball and everyone thinks, oh, we forgot to score. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, the offense looked great. The process was perfect, full marks, but you don't actually get points for that. You get points for putting the ball in the hoop. So start with the outcome. Exactly. We want to try and score and work backwards from there.
I listened to a rival podcast earlier this week, Adam. I just listen to one a week. And he had a really, really good point. Like, you don't want to put a coach's clinic on for your athletes. Like, you don't want to be so drilled in on all this crazy terminology that you would hear if you had 100 coaches in the room. But how do you actually get them to understand and picture, like, what are we actually trying to do here? As simply so that they're able to digest that information and find successes instead of just drowning them out with all this coach speak.
Yeah. Oh, geez. And there's tons of research to support that too. I like a colleague of mine, Damien Farrow, often used to say to me, less is more. And if that less is the outcome you want to achieve, or if you say to people, we want to try and free up whoever, Mary on for an open shot, then the players should have a pretty good idea of what to do in order to achieve that outcome. Of course, some level of structure is fine because it gives the players some level of certainty and familiarity, and it can guide their decision-making. I think the problem arises when they become so fixated on following all these list of rules and instructions that they actually forget to play the game and forget the basic principles of the game itself. That's when it becomes potentially problematic.
Awesome. Hey, I want to paint a little bit of a picture here for you and get your opinion on something. So we recently sent 4 girls and 3 boys away on our under-17 World Cup teams that went to Argentina and Latvia. If I took one of those athletes, so we're talking about one of the elite athletes in Melbourne, so say one of the girls, and this is what their schedule or their commitments were, tell me what your thoughts are on this. So what if they had to report to a school coach, a club coach, a senior team coach, a high performance coach, a state team coach, and a national team coach? How would that, in your opinion, sit with not only skill acquisition, but just also clarity of teaching?
Wow. So when you say report to, does that mean that they're being coached by each of those individuals in different practice sessions?
Potentially in a 7 to 10 day span, they could have to, have a practice or an instruction with each of those people.
Look, there's certainly the potential.
I've set you up for failure by asking the question.
I suspect this might be a bit of a loaded question.
It is loaded, mate, because I love skill development, I think it's the basis of a culture. A good team program culture is skill development and player development, because I think it invests the athletes. When athletes find themselves getting better, they're just so invested, their families are invested, they want to just be there. I do see this as our, in Melbourne, and I could see it in other cities and states as well, being our greatest challenger to, I'm talking elite, like we're talking world-class player development. I see this being our biggest challenger to world-class player development.
Yeah, look, and I think that the obvious point is that there's clearly the potential for a whole heap of different messages being provided, and that player is going to have a different role and different expectations and different information depending on which team they're playing in. Clearly there's the possibility for them to just get quite overwhelmed with it all. Having said that, if it's done, I mean, that many coaches, if there are, say, 5, 6, or 7 coaches, I don't know how you would ever manage that unless all the coaches had the same philosophy and same approach. But if it was at a manageable level, and how many coaches being involved with one athlete constitutes manageable, I don't know. But the fact that they are hearing different voices, being exposed to different structures, different roles within different teams. So a 6-foot girl might be playing clearly a centre for the local competition, but maybe a small forward or even a point guard at an international level competition. And so that variety, I was talking earlier about exploration, well, here that player has to kind of explore but certainly adapt her technique and her decision-making and everything to do with her game to all of those different roles. So I'm a point guard at an international level. Now, how do I adapt my capabilities to succeed there? Now I'm a centre playing in a local competition. How do I adapt to that? So, and then equally, how do I adapt to all the different coaches' points and structures, etc.? That can create, as long as it's not at the point where it's overwhelming, again, that challenge point really, that it's more of a hindrance than a benefit. If it helps them to adapt and develop this really broad skill set, imagine a player who could play just as well at centre as they could at point guard. I mean, that's outstanding. I think Magic Johnson played point guard and sometimes played centre at some points as well. I mean, that's your sort of your ideal, someone who's so incredibly adaptable that
diverse, you can just
throw anything at them and, yep, I know how to cope with this. Oh, you're changing this up? I can cope with that. That's your idea. And that's where training needs to be designed to facilitate, encourage, promote adaptability.
Yeah, and the other part to this challenge is that a lot of the times they've got good coaches in all contexts. Like they have a good club coach, a good state coach, a good national coach, a good player development coach, a good local coach or senior coach. And it's just the challenge of getting pulled in five directions in 1 week or in a fortnight that is the challenge for a lot of these athletes when everyone, at the end of the day, is trying to help with the same thing. We're trying to develop these robust, multi-skilled, talented athletes. But you do see it kind of, it is a challenge for us. When you're comparing it to the US system where, you know, they've got one high school they report to and that's it. Or the European club system where they've got one club, they report to that club 7 days a week and they control their pathway and development the whole way through. So it's just, and that's our country. That's how we've been set up on is the club association, whether it's cricket or netball. That's the grassroots of who we are as Australia. And how we manage that, I think, is really integral to the development of our kids.
Oh, without question. Yeah, definitely. We do have, and every country is unique. It's a good point in that we can't necessarily say, okay, what's the most successful country in the world? Basketball, and the US are standouts, but there's certainly others who are pushing them. Let's just copy their method, their system. Well, it's not as easy as a one-size-fits-all, of course, but that doesn't mean we can't take key elements from it and use those. We still need to perhaps tailor them, but we can still use them. I think ideally, I mean, if I was in that situation, if I was the sort of the club coach or rep coach and had a player of that caliber in my team, I'd be tempted to sort of say, look, you do what you need to do. I'll just give you some guidance here and there, but you're playing at the highest level. You probably don't need me to coach you too much. Of course, I'm going to try to advance your skill level and your understanding and you as a person. But, do what you do. Do it well. If I see anything, then we'll try to work on it together. But I might even chat up the chain and say to the other coaches who are coaching that same player, look, I've noticed this. Is this something that you've been working on? How have you gone about it? Just want to make sure that we've got consistency in the message we're providing to this individual, because there's nothing worse than being so overwhelmed with information that, and you can see it sometimes with players. They're on the court and you can see that they've seen something in the game that determines that a certain decision. They think, yep, no, this is the decision I should make. And you can hear in the background the coach yelling out a different decision or different option. And now you've got indecision on the part of the player. And that's where it becomes really debilitating, I think, for players. But, there's no question. It needs to be managed.
Hey, Adam, that pretty much wraps us up for time. Incredibly interesting discussion. We will absolutely get you back on the podcast as well, and maybe some listeners have got some questions they'd like us to ask you as well. By all means, send those in and we'll hit you up another time. But really appreciate your time for it. It's been fantastic talking to you. And we'll certainly touch base with you soon.
That sounds awesome. It's my pleasure. And, more than happy to respond to any questions and to chat to you again further. It's been a good experience.
We fired our last podcast host, so we got an open spot if you want to be a regular too, mate.
Thanks very much, Adam. We'll talk to you later.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, mate.
So a massive thank you, obviously, to Adam Gorman for jumping into us. We've been trying to get a hold of him for a couple of weeks now, and he's a very busy man. So any time he's able to give us is greatly appreciated. But great chat, lots of great ideas on that. You loaded him up with a couple of questions yourself, Mike.
No, not at all.
Might have been a slight vested interest on a few of them, but incredible things to take away from that I think a lot of coaches can really learn a lot from.
Absolutely, mate. I love some of the little tidbits that he threw out there, like a solution that didn't work. Like, don't just say something is a failure. Yeah. It's a solution that just didn't work. Let's look for the next solution. And you read things about Einstein and these scientists who experimented back in the day. Like, they would falter like 200, 300, 400 times before finding that solution. So I just love the way that you don't let failures or non-successes not weigh you down. Skill growth spurts was really, really interesting.
It's cool, isn't it?
Really interesting. And you do. You encounter these athletes, and I've got a couple in mind now, just in the couple of years that I've been around BV, that something does happen in an 8 to 10 week spurt or an 8 to 10 week segment of the year, and you're like, wow, that kid could not do that 10 weeks ago. And the way that those skill growth spurts are managed, and also the patience that's needed to actually let that skill growth spurt take place is huge. And the big one that it's just a reflection of my time in the US, Robbie, is something that is completely missing from our environment here in Australia is pickup basketball. And the experimentation and the no constraints that takes place in pickup basketball is something that we should be trying to get into our athletes as much as possible. And it is that backyard learning, like just having five people, boys, girls, it doesn't matter. It's both boys and girls need to play pickup. Just to play and experiment and shoot bad shots and get better that way is something that we do need to find a way to foster here in Australia.
And a flow on from that is let the game be the teacher. And that ties in a lot with our small-sided games, our two-on-twos, our three-on-threes, our four-on-fours, our disadvantage work as well. There's a great way to learn, and it's not necessarily through being overcoached. And it is something I talk to coaches about a lot, is can you overcoach? Like, can you give too much direction? And listening to him about where is the level? What is that critical point where it's like too much information? They're now overstimulated, stressed out, way too hard for the athlete. And ultimately, that's what it needs to be about. It has to be about the athlete. And are they learning at the correct pace? Well, their own pace will dictate that. Some kids can handle a lot. Some kids can't handle a lot. Mm-hmm. So there's different levels of that as well. It, you know, the quality practice I thought was really interesting as well. So yes, you can practice shooting, but are you practicing shooting 1-on-0 by yourself with no defense? And so does it really matter? Because you're never going to get that shot in a game unless something's gone drastically wrong from the opposition. So
shooting's an interesting one. There is an element where if you can't make the shot 1-on-0, I promise you cannot make it 1-on-1.
Yep.
But there is an element of that. So you do need a technique that you are getting enough work into. And, you know, Eric spoke about like regimented focus to being a good shooter. So what does your regimented development look like for your shooting technique or your shooting ability? There is an element of that. What the COE does a really good job of is sprinkling in the contested shooting into that. And they've got a series of drills where it's literally just, you know, the ball starts on the elbow, someone's in the seam, and they cut, they're on the move, so they're catching it on the move, and you toss them the ball, and you just go out and 50%, 60% challenge. And you just play first three makes. And so they're those little things, and they're really not rocket science drills at all.
Like, and can be done at any level. Like, there's nothing wrong with doing it with under 12 athletes. There's nothing wrong with doing it with your senior athletes. Ultimately, kids want competition. They want games. They want to be challenged. And I think that's a great way of providing that to the training sessions as well.
The other one to that is we talk about shooting the basketball, finishing the basketball in the paint as well. So just the regular right-hand layup, left-hand layup with somebody standing there is completely different than not. So just some dummy defense or some very minimal contact does change the athlete's mindset and how they're actually going to finish in and around the rim. And it is absolutely a certainty that if you cannot finish in the paint or at the rim, you're going to have a hard time winning games at the elite level.
Yep. And probably one of the other things, like a practice audit. Just how many shot attempts does every athlete get during it? I know it's something I'm going to try and experiment. We've only got a couple of weeks left to go of our season unless we go on a massive winning streak somewhere and make it all the way through. But it is something I'm going to be a little bit conscious of now of, okay, can I video a practice? How many shots are each athlete going to get?
Absolutely.
How many time with the ball in their hands? How many times have I had to make a decision during the actual session itself? So it is something we do a lot of planning pre-practice. But the after practice is just as important, I think.
I know Football Federation Australia did a massive research into their junior development pathway, you know, a decade and longer ago now. And a part of their research was in these 11-on-11 games with under 12 kids, like how many touches are the kids actually getting of the ball in a game? And you can imagine it's not as many as if you were having a 5-on-5 game on a much smaller pitch. Part of why the Brazilians are really good at soccer, and this is in the Talent Code book that's really popular out there, is that they play these varied games of like futsal in these really tight, constrained football pitches, and they're not even, they're like on dirt, where you have to be really good in tight spaces with the ball. So that's another interesting one that, that's a podcast in itself right there, Robbie.
It is. So big thanks to Adam Gorman for jumping in on that. We'll be sure to get him back on. And if you do have any questions or thoughts on that, by all means, send them
in. Yeah, we'd love to know.
And we'll have a look at that for the future. So we're on to the weekend news. So there's been a little bit going on in the basketball world.
Always stuff going on, Robbie.
Our under-18 men, Australian team.
Really good job. Congrats to Darren Perry, Vic Metro coach, and his staff, who did a great job in Thailand, went through undefeated and beat New Zealand in the gold medal game.
They did. Our under-18 women's team has just been picked, so the Gems. So they're off, where are they?
Off to India, Robbie. You know where that is?
I do, north of here.
Very good, mate. So five Victorian girls made that squad, which is awesome for them. Yep. So wish them all the best.
So they'll be going through the same qualifying tournament the men just went through. Correct. So obviously the men's team has just qualified for World, so women need a top four finish, I believe.
Correct.
I think
correct.
It is to go to World.
Yep. Correct, and that World Cup will be next year, Robbie.
It will. So, number of college visits have been going on. So, we've had a number of schools out over very the last
active,
week.
Very active, Robbie. Australia, again, a popular place for these Division One universities to visit. So, we've had St. Mary's in town this past week. Both the men and the women Hawaiian teams have been in Melbourne. Loyola Marymount is still in Melbourne. They've got a game against Melbourne United tomorrow night or Thursday night in Casey. The Marquette women, who were a second round NCAA tournament team last year, were in town, and Drexel will be in town as well over the weekend and playing a couple games next week here in Melbourne. So a lot of opportunities for people to get out there, a lot of games. I know they've been publicised on the internet for the last couple of weeks, but if you want to go see some Division One athletes, definitely get out and check a game.
No question. So the last thing for us is we have the Peter Lonigan Clinic on Monday night at Mullum Stadium. Distance is no excuse for this one. We are live streaming this. You can get all the Robbie. Detail on the Basketball Victoria website. So those of you that are in town, you always get more when you do attend the clinic, I must admit. But for those of you that logistically simply can't make it, there are all the details on the website. So Peter Lonigan's talking on skill development with small-sided games.
Get there, so. Robbie. He's one of the best clinicians, not just in our country, but in all the countries of the world, Robbie. And it will be awesome. So we'll have a handful of our NITP athletes on the floor, and it will be a really, really great clinic.
Always is. Eventually, we'll have that up on the BV website along with all our other coaching clinics.
Junior NBA, Robbie, last one, wrapped up over the weekend. Really good job. It looked like the event was awesome.
Yeah,
it
ran really well from the looks of things.
From the community service stuff that the athletes and the families got to take part in, to the visits from, like, I saw photos with Dwayne Wade and Andre Drummond, and Swing Cash was like, it was unbelievable the experiences that these athletes and these kids would have gotten over those 2 weeks. So the girls lost to Europe in the final of the international bracket. The boys bowed out in the semi of the international bracket, but I suggest that the experiences they got are going to help them
out of this world. Realistically, it's how often do you get to see that brand of basketball up close and personal and participate in it? The connections, like, we would hope that a few of those players have played against future NBA, WNBA, Team USA, you know, European athletes that will be at World and Olympic Games. Mm. So it's an outstanding opportunity for those guys as well.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned on the pod last week, I hope they come back and are like, oh my goodness, that's what a basketball player in the US looks like at the age of 14, and that's what a basketball player from Serbia looks like at 14. Like, I hope that there's a bit of that impact on the coaches, so they can kind of spread that message around Victoria and Australia, but also the athletes as a motivator to, you know, I've got to play and develop.
Yep, absolutely. So that wraps us up. We are done. Much more efficient without Justin, I find.
More efficient. I think the clarity, like, there's no leaning back in the chairs. I think this is just going to work really, really well.
Robbie. It will. And I mean, realistically, that person that gave us the 1-star review, no question that's Shula related.
Absolutely.
So we'll give you the opportunity over the course of this week to go and change that to a 5-star.
Retract.
Exactly right. So once again, if you can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes, Spotify, do please leave ratings and reviews. And if you can like, share, and retweet the podcast, we would really appreciate it on our end too. We're back next week.
Awesome.
We roll on. With one member down, we're still okay.
We're good.
No problems at all. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll catch you guys. Thanks for talking split with us.